Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
After three fruitless efforts, Florida's cabinet officers have finally found the state's next insurance commissioner.
That we extend the position of commissioner to the Office of Insurance of Regulation to David Altmaier.
Governor Rick Scott is heading to California in hopes of bringing back some jobs. And while some are raising their eyebrows at his tactics, others say Scott's just doing what business-focused governors do.
For the governor's kind of core constituency, this is good politics.
And we'll resume our conversation with Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones, plus a preview of the U.S. Senate race. That's ahead on Capital Report. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan, and you're listening to Capital Report. Welcome to tonight's show. In a hastily arranged meeting Friday, Florida's cabinet members interviewed three more insurance commissioner candidates, eventually promoting Deputy Commissioner David Altmaier. In the two previous hearings, Nick Evans reports the governor and CFO have clashed over nominees.
On his third attempt Friday, the Florida cabinet reached an agreement on the state's next insurance chief. Deputy Commissioner David Altmaier will be stepping into the role. The cabinet favored the dark horse candidate in part because of an impasse between Governor Rick Scott.
I move to appoint Jeffrey Bragg as commissioner of the Office of Insurance Regulation at a salary of $150,000.
And CFO Jeff Atwater.
Governor, I'd like to make a motion that the position of the Commissioner of Insurance Regulation be extended to Representative Bill Hager with a salary of $190,000.
The stalemate derailed the search because Florida law requires both officers agree on the appointment, a statutory check meant to ensure commissioners are prized for competence rather than connections. And that gridlock persisted as fellow cabinet members Attorney General Pam Bondi and Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam refused to put a thumb on the scale for a favored candidate. Here's Bondi.
I would hope that once you two gentlemen come to an agreement, unless I believe someone is woefully inadequate, which I hope I won't based on the two of you and your great experience in this field, then hopefully I'll be able to back your candidate. But I think the two of you need to come to an agreement first.
Friday morning, the cabinet room was nearly empty during interviews with three senior officials from the Office of Insurance Regulation. Only CFO Atwater was on hand. The other three officers called in on the phone instead. David Altmaier was the final interview. His expertise is in property and casualty insurance, and CFO Atwater pressed him on the rise in water damage claims.
So I would say that, yes, there does appear to be an increasing trend in the frequency and the severity of water losses in our property market. It is a concern.
Insurers have been sounding the alarm that water claims are rising despite more than a decade without a hurricane. Those insurers point the finger at assignment of benefits. It's an agreement where the property owner signs over insurance benefits to the company cleaning up or making repairs after damage. Rightly or wrongly, those companies are often able to extract larger claims from the insurer. And in recent sessions, a number of GOP lawmakers have made an effort to undermine the process. But Altmaier stops short of rejecting assignments.
The root of the problem there is that the assignment of benefits mechanism is being taken advantage of by a small number of market participants. And so I think that the best way to move forward with that is to look at the assignment of benefits mechanism, determine where there is opportunity for people to take advantage of that system, and look for ways that we can eliminate those opportunities while keeping intact the ability for consumers to utilize the assignment of benefits mechanism in situations in which it was intended to be used for.
The hearing concluded with a strange dance between Atwater and Scott.
I think it makes sense we just go ahead and move on to the candidates we have here today. I think both Rich and David are both extremely qualified and would do an outstanding job.
Rich and David are Richard Robledo and David Altmaier, the two deputy commissioners the cabinet interviewed Friday. But Atwater first reiterated his support for two earlier candidates, Republican Representative Bill Hager and OIR Chief of Staff Belinda Miller, both times with no response. On his third motion, he proposed Altmaier.
I would make this motion that we extend the position of commissioner to the Office of Insurance of Regulation to David Altmaier,
with a starting salary of $160,000.
But in an odd postscript, the session may come with a significant price tag. Scott misheard Atwater's motion, and instead, Altmaier's salary will be $165,000. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Governor Rick Scott is continuing his tradition of trying to lure businesses from democratically led states. Scott is now targeting California, but Regan McCarthy reports it doesn't look like he's getting a warm welcome.
Scott released a radio ad in advance of his trip. It claims a minimum wage increase in California will lead to 700,000 lost jobs.
Ready to leave California? Go to Florida instead. No state income tax, and Governor Scott has cut regulations. Now Florida is adding 1 million jobs, not losing them.
But California Governor Jerry Brown isn't taking Scott's overtures sitting down. Brown released a statement pushing back against the ad. In the statement, Brown sarcastically welcomes Scott as one of, in his words, millions of tourists flocking to the Golden State. He also says California has added twice as many jobs as Florida and claims Scott's been ignoring issues like climate change and poverty.
He kind of took one on the chin there. I mean, I think Brown's response was pretty funny.
That's Florida State University political science professor Charles Berrio. He says while some might read Brown's response as a zinger, he doubts Scott has given it much thought.
For the governor's kind of core constituency, this is good politics. They don't think it looks foolish at all for the governor to go out and do that. You know, if Jerry Brown doesn't like it, I think a lot of the governor's constituents say, well, of course, they don't like Jerry Brown anyway.
And Berrio's analysis seemed to ring true when, during a conversation with reporters, Scott brushed off Brown's statements.
So, Governor, in the response to your trip there, the governor's office is saying that you're ignoring issues here in Florida like poverty and climate change.
Now let's look at the facts. I got elected on a campaign to get our state back to work. In 2010, I said there'd be 700,000 jobs over 7 years, and now we're at 1,061,000 jobs. Our labor force is growing faster than California, or wage growth, or job growth rate is faster than California.
This isn't the first time Scott's gotten pushback from states where he's trying to recruit jobs. The governor's pitch to get Yale University to move met with a bit of incredulity from the school and even journalists.
I think it's a bit of a ridiculous suggestion.
I think it's outstanding. Look at all the reasons why you should come to Florida. You can look at how many people are moving here. You look at how annual income is moving here. Our weather's better. Our crime rate's at 44.5-year low. I can give you all the reasons.
FSU's Berrio points out Scott's not the first to use the tactic. He says former Texas Governor Rick Perry and other business-focused governors have also gone job hunting in Democratic states. Scott wraps up his trip on the 3rd. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll continue the conversation with Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones.
A year ago, I probably told you I've known nothing about prisons and don't know anything about running a prison, but I don't need to. I have a lot of people that know how to run a prison, and they're good at it.
A well-known Florida political scientist talks about the race to fill Florida U.S. Senator Marco Rubio's seat.
It's been a very long time in Florida politics where we've had highly competitive primary races on both sides of the aisle for a U.S. Senate seat that's open.
And we'll get to meet some of those candidates.
There's a growing storm on the horizon that threatens our constitutional republic that nobody wants to talk about. We are moving closer and closer to a post-constitutional era.
In the last of a two-part series, Sasha Cordner continues the conversation with Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones. She's been in her role for more than a year. Tonight, we'll hear more about what direction she'd like the prison agency to take, what's in store for some of her employees, and her take on certain legal challenges affecting the agency.
So you just began transitioning to a new prison health provider to replace Corizon Health, who pulled out last year. It covers most of the state's inmate medical care. How is that going so far?
It's phenomenal what the Centurion has been able to do in a short period of time. The goal is to transfer all 41 of the facilities by the end of May, and they're well on their way to hiring the existing Corizon employees, but also they are a nationwide company, and they are looking nationally to backfill with doctors, nurses, and psychiatrists and psychologists. And those last two are key to stabilizing the inmate population and giving us a chance at rehabilitating an inmate.
So just off of that, I know an administrative law judge just rejected the other prison health provider Wexford's challenge to Centurion coming in. But are you guys still working well with Wexford right now?
We have a solid relationship with Wexford. From a corporate standpoint, Wexford has to do everything that they can to affect their bottom line and make sure that they position the company well, and I don't take offense to that. We were able to get Wexford a cost of living increase, so they're going to get a little bit of a pay increase this year for the increased services that we've asked them to do for us and the increase in costs for medicine and basic supplies. So no, Wexford and the department are doing just fine.
Speaking of challenges, I know that the Teamsters Union, which represents thousands of correctional officers, has an upcoming legal challenge stating that your agency can fire correctional officers without justification. Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, all we're doing is following state law. And the Teamsters tried to negotiate something that is in state law to give themselves an exemption. But quite frankly, to say that an individual that promotes does not go back on probation relative to their ability to do that new job doesn't make any sense to me. Because some people are really good at being a corrections officer and maybe might not be a very good supervisor. And we want to keep that individual but let them be a corrections officer again if they can't make the grade as a supervisor. To totally exempt that individual from scrutiny in a probationary period on promotion, I think, was unreasonable. And so what the legislature did was agree with the department, but more succinctly, the legislature said follow state statute.
So in the past, your agency started releasing correctional officer arrests regarding contraband, inmate abuse, but it looks like you're now releasing inmate on prison guard assaults as well?
We are. And it's something that we used to do years ago. But I think when we talk about how difficult the job is, how stressful, how dangerous, why wouldn't we also talk about the human toll on our staff and what we're doing to change the environment for our staff and the inmate? And to do that, we're not highlighting it, but we are posting these incidents. So, again, in an era of the department being very transparent, I think it's important that the public know all sides to what is the correctional story. And this is a dangerous, difficult job, and I want to make sure that we're doing right by our officers.
And you just attended the Criminal Justice Reform Colloquium at Yale University, where you were joined by many criminal justice experts.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how that was? Why did you go, and what did you talk about?
Right now, prison reform, prison justice reform, these discussions are happening all over the country. It has a lot to do with death penalty, no death penalty. It has to do with segregated housing, the use of solitary confinement, which we don't use that term in Florida, but we do have a small, very small cohort of people that are very dangerous. But the discussion is how best to interact with an inmate in that difficult situation and not just lock them up, but give them the tools in that segregated situation where they're by themselves to begin to modify their behavior and give them a chance to get out of there and not just lock them up and not give them any services. Florida doesn't do that. But again, I want to know what the national dialogue is, and I want to be able to be ready with information on what we do, how we do it. And if there's an idea out there that we should be embracing, what better way to do it than to sit down with the ACLU, sit down with people that are looking at all angles beyond just the crime and punishment piece, but the social aspect of incarceration. So I know where the future leads, and I can properly position the department.
So you've run this agency for more than a year now. What are some of the highlights? What are your challenges even moving forward, looking ahead?
I had the pleasure of meeting with all the wardens and with all of our chiefs, which are majors and colonels. And these are the leaders of tomorrow. And I'm challenging them to think about what we look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, because especially the majors and the colonels, they're the ones that are going to be here. I probably won't be here in 10 years. I will be happily retired somewhere, I hope. Getting them to step up and to engage. I use a term that's called loyal opposition and then unity of command. Getting my boots on the ground supervisors to acknowledge not only their responsibility, but giving them some authority in their environment to affect change, and to be able to intercede with an officer, with an inmate, and make a change. And I'm talking positive change. I'm not talking punitive, because a lot of what we're talking about now in open discussions is how to use incentives with inmates and to incentivize behavior. And so it's the carrot stick idea. And I have been extremely pleased with the interaction with our employees are motivated. They're excited. And I, when I took this job, was very concerned that we push for change, but not for change's sake, and that we're doing things for the right reasons, and we justify what we do. And take segregation for an example. If an inmate attacks a corrections officer or attacks another inmate, we obviously have to segregate that individual, and we have policies and procedures to do that. But if you act out and push somebody, if you are disrespectful, if you use negative language, maybe we don't necessarily put that person in confinement. We find other ways to motivate. We're looking at tablets to encourage education. We're looking at transition programs, thinking for a change. And so incentivizing behavior as opposed to using just strictly discipline. We have individuals coming up through the chain of command with ideas like there's no tomorrow. It's exciting. And it's an exciting time. And I'm very good at what I do in a leadership role and in talking to the legislature. A year ago, I probably told you I've known nothing about prisons and don't know anything about running a prison, but I don't need to. I have a lot of people that know how to run a prison, and they're good at it. It's getting them motivated and giving them the authority to make change and reshape what we look like, and that's what we're doing, because we are doing a lot of good things, and it's not the old DOC, and we changed the name, and we've changed the uniform to motivate people to think about how to do this differently, because 87% of the inmates that come into our custody go back to community, and so it's exciting time. It's exciting times for us.
All right. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
That's Florida Public Radio's Sasha Cordner speaking to Department of Corrections Secretary Julie Jones at her Tallahassee headquarters. Finally on Capitol Report, a two-parter. Pundits are scratching their heads over one of the most competitive and perplexing U.S. Senate races in Florida history. The five best-known Republicans include two congressmen and two scions of Cuban immigrant families, Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantera and Bradenton developer Carlos Baruff. The Democratic slate also includes two congressmen, Patrick Murphy and Alan Grayson. Grayson, a millionaire hedge fund manager, is facing an ethics investigation. Jim Ash talked to University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus about the race.
What strikes me as a little odd is this late in the game, this close to the primary, there doesn't appear to be a front runner. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. In fact, I get stopped all the time and people say there's not much going on with the U.S. Senate race. And of course, there's a reason for it. You know, it's not the time when spending a lot of money on TV ads is going to garner you much attention, because people are so engrossed in the presidential race in some of these big states still yet to come. So it looks like it's a delay game that these candidates are engaged in, but meanwhile, it means that time will be a lot shorter for them to grab people's attention before the August 30th primary. And as you know, it's very, very competitive on both sides of the aisle this time.
We have two candidates with an immigration story in their history, and I'm wondering if that makes it difficult for Hispanic voters to decide or distinguish.
There again, it's going to take a lot of outreach and really engaging the Hispanic communities across the state, because especially those, the new arrivals from Puerto Rico, largely concentrated along the I-4 corridor, but there's also a heavy presence in South Florida, they have a different, they have to use a different approach to campaign towards them. It's much more personal. And, of course, radio enters into the equation for the Puerto Rican voters, but so does sort of in-the-street bus rides through town honking horns. So, you know, the diversity of the Hispanic communities themselves in Florida. We have the most diverse Hispanic population of any state. Heavy percentages of Puerto Ricans, Venezuelans, Cubans, Mexicans, Dominicans, you name it. We have a wide range of Hispanics, and it's not the case that you can campaign using the same techniques effectively with every single one of those groups. Country of origin has a lot of play.
You know, on the Democratic side, you have a couple of colorful members of Congress. I'm wondering if the ethics investigation is going to hurt one of them.
It's certainly going to be something that will be a preeminent part of the opponent's ads, you can bet. And if they have a debate, which we will, it looks like, have a Senate debate, maybe not at the primary level, but ultimately, if Grayson does get the nomination, certainly the debate between he and the potential Republican nominee could absolutely be guaranteed to bring up that particular issue. But so too is Patrick Murphy, who's running against Grayson. He's obviously trying to tap into that. It's been a very long time in Florida politics where we've had highly competitive primary races on both sides of the aisle for a U.S. Senate seat that's open.
And you could argue that what happens in Cleveland may determine the outcome of this race, right?
Well, you certainly have to wonder about it. I mean, here's the thing that we know about Florida politics is that Republicans can't win the White House without winning Florida. And Democrats this time out absolutely do not want to lose Florida. And precisely why both sides are salivating over that U.S. Senate seat. For Democrats, they would love nothing better than to take back that seat, which would help them get closer to their goal of adding or flipping 5 Republican seats, which would enable them to actually take control of the U.S. Senate. And the Republicans want nothing more than to hold on, and they're trying to hold on for dear life. So there's going to be mega bucks spent by super PACs from outside of the state.
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. Nice talking with you.
Same here.
And now Kate Payne takes a look at some of the better-known candidates who are trying to replace Marco Rubio in the U.S. Senate.
There are 27 candidates vying for a spot in the U.S. Senate. With an August 30th primary looming, there is still no clear frontrunner. Here's a look at some of the big names in the race.
If you get sick, America, the Republican health care plan is this. Die quickly. That's right.
That's Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson addressing Congress in 2008. The Senate candidate recently said the upside of climate change is that Rush Limbaugh's Palm Beach home will be destroyed by rising sea levels. He's known for his incendiary statements, but Grayson also considers himself a strong progressive with an eye towards inequality. But he's plagued by an ongoing ethics investigation into his involvement in an offshore hedge fund. Grayson's Democratic rival is Congressman Patrick Murphy of Jupiter. He boasts the endorsement of Joe Biden and Barack Obama and presents himself as clean-cut in contrast to his opponent.
If you ask me, that's no way to get something done with people, right? By definition, in a divided government, you're going to have to find some common ground with people, whether they're in your own party or the other party. Either way, you got to find the common ground and move the ball forward.
Meanwhile, the Republican ticket is packed, but still no clear front runner. Congressman David Jolly of Indian Shores recently broke with party leadership, saying climate change is real and Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland deserves a vote. Jolly is gaining support for his STOP Act to limit fundraising for members of Congress.
Let's get members of Congress off the phone shaking down the American people for money. That's one way to do it. And then let's begin to address how do we get to a better campaign finance system than we have now.
Also in the running is Florida's Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantera. The Miami Republican has experience in state government, first in the legislature and now as the governor's second in command.
We've reduced regulations, reduced licensing weights, and it's that created the business environment that has allowed this state to add over 1,035,000 jobs since the recession.
In a party where many see terrorism as the greatest threat to the country, two contenders say they're best qualified to combat ISIS. Congressman Ron DeSantis of Pontevedra is a former military prosecutor with an Ivy League education. With a recent Defeat the Jihad talking tour under his belt, he's building a campaign on the threat of terror.
We brought down communism, which was a very, very pernicious totalitarian ideology. I think what makes radical Islam perhaps more dangerous is that it's rooted in a suicidal view of humanity.
Meanwhile, former CIA officer, sniper, and millionaire Todd Wilcox casts himself as a political outsider. Last fall, he told a group of Florida Republicans he sees America in decline, likening the country's trajectory to the fall of Rome.
There's a growing storm on the horizon that threatens our constitutional republic that nobody wants to talk about. We are moving closer and closer to a post-constitutional era. This is more dangerous than the growing ISIS threat. It's more dangerous than the growing trend of isolationist foreign policy.
Wilcox recently scooped up the endorsement of Alan Coors, president of the National Rifle Association. The last candidate to enter the race is Sarasota developer Carlos Baruf. He's the child of Cuban refugees and says he's living the American dream.
I won the lottery because my mother, in March 13th of 1957, was the only woman conspirator on the failed attack on the presidential palace in Havana, Cuba.
Some have likened him to Donald Trump for his statements on Middle Eastern immigrants and refugees. The presidential race continues to outshine the Senate contest. But political scientists say Florida voters could play a key role in handing the chamber to the Democrats or maintaining a Republican majority. The primary is August 30th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us Fridays for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.